Queens Council. I first want to start on behalf of the entire council. We hope you are all doing well. You're safe and healthy during this unprecedented time. I'm sure none of us thought that we would still be managing this crisis up until this point. We had expected to have a live conference, but you know, obviously that has changed and we don't know what the next year holds either. So we want to thank you for being here. I know that many of you have participated in the council Zoom meetings that we've continued to run on the first Monday of every month, which we intend to do that at least until the end of the calendar year. We're expecting that the council meetings will continue to be virtual through January through June, which is our calendar year. Most likely our legislative breakfast, which is typically held in March, is going to be virtual as well. And we'll talk more about that at upcoming council meetings. But again, we hope that you're all well and we're glad that you're able to be here today. What I'd like to do, I just want to give an overview of what the conference will be like throughout the week. So it's a full week event. And this session right now is our introduction. So I'm talking on behalf of the council to just give you an overview of the conference. We have representatives from OPWDD who will give you an update. We have Tom McElvana, the executive director of the Interagency Council, which is a trade association for members, providers, to give you an update of what's happening on the advocacy front, locally and statewide. And then we will, then this session will end, and then we start our workshops. There'll be 8 workshops throughout the entire week. The schedule has been sent out. It's also on our website with all of the Zoom links. For today, the next workshop starts at 12:30. And as Pat Barrientos started, all of the sessions are being recorded, so that families, if they're not able to go to every session, they'll have an opportunity to view it at a later date. And if any of you, if professionals are on the call and you have to jump off, please know that this will be posted on our website to view probably for the entire year. We'll also be sending it to you. We have translation in Spanish, Mandarin, and we also have sign language. For the first time. We have not had sign language in any of our live conferences. So I want to thank the team of translators and American Sign Language. Thank you for all being here today. Hopefully we won't have too many technology glitches. And with that, I also want to thank Pat Barrientos, who's also from CUSAC, but he is one of the members of the Council's Public Information Committee. He's the tech support behind today's event and this week's event. So thank you, Pat. We wouldn't have been able to do it without you. Pat will be behind the scenes on every session. So if you hear him chiming in, that's why. We won't be taking live questions, but we will try to answer questions in the chats. Our presenters, each will manage their own sessions in their own way, but typically, again, it'll be done through chats. They may answer questions as they come in or wait until the end. But again, they won't be calling out on the Zoom questions. This has been a challenging year. I'm going to speak from a provider perspective for a moment. Pre-COVID, we were going into a challenging budget year with cuts expected due to the New York State deficit, which at the time was around $6, $7, maybe $8 billion. And now with COVID, it's double that. It's more than double that. So as the state struggles, so too do providers. And not even just in the IDDD world, but in mental health and all areas throughout the state. The MTA, I'm sure you've heard, is struggling. As the state struggles with their finances, it trickles down to the community at large and all of us, all the work that we do and other human service fields. And that's why it's so important that we get federal support. And it's especially important given this is a tremendous election year. So I just have to put a shout out there to this early voting. Get out there and vote. Next week is election day. Make sure that your voice is heard and your vote, you know, every vote counts. And these are some really critical times. And Tom's going to talk more about some of the advocacy that providers are doing. I also want to note that when I sent out the email, you know, this event is typically workshops and a resource fair. And our resource fair is when we have about 70 vendors, provider agencies set up tables with all of their service information, flyers and brochures about all the services they have available. We've asked providers to send us a link to either their website with their contact information or to flyers that list the services they currently have available or foresee having in the near future. Many providers are struggling. Some are not. Some are providing services. Some have modified services. So we felt that in order for it to be really relevant to families today, to try to list what families can find today with different agencies. Also, some organizations have changes in staffing. So who you typically went to for intake or for services, some of those names and contact information may have changed. So you'll see a link for that. You can also get that on our website. We'll continue to update that. So if providers on the call, you say, wait, you know, I want to get our agency up there, just email me and we'll make it happen. I was getting calls over the weekend, emails over the weekend, and we were posting it. So we would just want to make information available to as many families. And although, you know, we're Queens, many providers serve multiple boroughs. So if there are care managers on the call, feel free to visit that, even if you serve other boroughs. It's important that if providers do have vacancies and services available, that we fulfill those. We need to demonstrate that, you know, services are needed and being provided. So what I'd like to do, I want to just thank all of the council, my colleagues on the council. You know, all of us work for agencies and we essentially volunteer our time to keep the council going because we're committed to the IDD community and helping other providers and our families and the individuals that we serve. So I want to thank our team. My parent co-chair, Jim Karp, who usually speaks. Unfortunately, he got called last minute for grand jury duty, which, you know, obviously he could not reschedule, but we may be doing a specific workshop in November or December on self-direction, which will be led in part by Jim Karp. So there'll be more information on that to come. So I want to thank Mary Knox, vice chairperson from Little Flower and Curbano is a parent vice chairperson. And she's also leads parent to parent. So the council is made up of many, many people. They're all listed and I will get an opportunity to thank them throughout the week. But it takes a village to run an event like this and to run the council. So I want to thank all of my colleagues. So with that, I see James Daugherty is on the call. James, are you giving the OPW report or is Delia? And if she's not on the call yet, we can move to Tom. Pat, can you unmute, allow James to unmute?
Yes, let me just find him. I just saw him too. James.
All right, can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
All right, I'll be speaking on behalf of the regional office. Delia is away today, so I'll be doing that. I think Crystal Sharp and a number of other OPWDD regional office staff are also on the Zoom. So I'm just going to take just a couple minutes and say a few words. I think most people on this call are probably up to date with the current circumstances, not only with the pandemic, but also with OPWDD and the provision of services. So I guess I'll just want to say good morning and thanks for giving us an opportunity to say a few words. You know, obviously the landscape, I'm going to move my, so I'm looking at the camera. Okay. Sorry about that. So obviously the landscape this year is very different from last year's conference, where individuals, families, and providers are facing, you know, very difficult set of challenges. The coronavirus health emergency has impacted New York State unlike any other that we've experienced. We know that vulnerable populations, including people with compromised health status, aging people, and those that live in congregate settings are more susceptible to COVID-19. Since the pandemic in New York State, we've taken significant action to minimize the opportunities for the introduction of the coronavirus into congregate care locations and to prevent the transmission of the virus to individuals and staff in instances where it occurred. Individuals and families have certainly had to adapt during periods of suspension, temporary suspension of such programs as non-residential, day-hab programs, com-hab respite, and other employment programs, as well as visitation to residential programs. Those certainly have been lifted, but there was a period of time where, families, I think, were certainly facing challenges and trying to adapt, you know, with those suspensions. OPWD continues to take safety precautions, such as encouraging appropriate PPEs, the reporting of positive cases for tracking, giving guidance on appropriate visitation and community outings, on social distancing, temperature checking, and quarantining as we carefully return to a new normal. We realize that this has been a difficult time for everyone and difficult decisions have had to be made, but certainly our number one priority is and continues to be the health and safety of all the people that we support. Our efforts now are focusing on balancing with the balance of minimizing risk with the transmission with the benefits of reopening. We continue to update the guidance concerning supports and services and safety as COVID-19 health emergency continues to evolve, making needed changes as we're able. I want to point everyone to, probably seen it, but we have on our website, I believe it's over 80 guidance documents now that can be found on a range of different topic areas. To find that, you go to our OPWDD homepage, click on COVID-19 guidance. The next page, scroll to the bottom, and you can click on See All Documents. And then you can scroll through. They're all PDFs, and so you can view them on your computer or download them, you know, as you please. And certainly, we'll continue to work with and engage stakeholders, including families and advocacy groups, as well as provider agencies, and new guidance will be developed, you know, as we go forward, based on the current circumstances. The regional offices are all open. I think everyone is aware of that. We are, majority of us are working remotely still. But we are checking voicemail and emails throughout the day, and we're able to attend to our, various operational areas and needs. The New York City Queens office, if you need to call us, the number is 6485. And I guess the last couple words I'll say is, you know, I know that the commissioner has been throughout the state meeting with advocacy and provider groups, hearing the needs and getting their input as we, as an agency, continue to try to adapt and adjust to the new normal. Thanks again, everyone, for letting me say a few words, and I wish everyone the very best and a good conference.
Thank you. Thank you very much, James. We appreciate you being here and speaking on behalf of OPWDD. And I just want to remind everyone and do a special shout out to the folks at the Queens Regional Office of OPW who always attend meetings and share information. That includes Delia Tucker, Crystal Sharp, Robin Mooney, Vilma Gilling, and Francina Branch. Thank you all for your support over the years and with this conference. Robin and Vilma were very involved in helping the council pull this off this week, so thank you both. And I also want to take this opportunity to thank our partners at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, who also regularly attend meetings and share information from the city. And that's Gavin Myers and Janice Chisholm, who are, you know, both our partners and supporters during this time and in the past, and we know in the future. So I'm going to introduce Tom Macavana from, most of you know Tom, who's been in the industry for, I'll let him reveal how many years. And he is currently the executive director of the Interagency Council, who is also a partner for many of the providers in our industry. So Tom, welcome and thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks for give me a few minutes today to address everybody. Hello, Queens, my old hometown where I was born and raised and went to school and started as a DSP back in the 70s, way last century somewhere. I've been fortunate enough to be among some of the best people I've ever had the privilege to work with and to partner with and to make friends and to see the magic that this field is, the magic of parents and individuals and providers together that have built this amazing system, even with all of its flaws, even with all of its trials, and even with all of its the problems we have with underfunding. I think if in times that we live in, we cannot lose hope that we will be able to withstand what is thrown at us. I think that's part of the human condition. I think that's part of many of us in this field who know the value of each human being on their own, and that we all celebrate together as a community. And we continue to believe in the mission that we have in front of us, which is a civil rights and hope for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. That has been, you know, my my career and my life's aspiration, and I think many of you as well. I think that one of the things I wanted to do, if you would just allow me a couple minutes, this has been such a difficult time. I think James mentioned how the field, OPWDD, has never seen anything like this. I know all of us have never seen anything like this before. The only thing that comes close to it in terms of a year that has brought such trials, such heartache, was 1968. For those of us old enough to remember that year, a lot of what we are seeing today, with the exception of COVID, but a lot of what we're seeing has echoes of the past. And I think that if we have to remember the past in order to be able to learn the lessons that are new, but taking our experience and what we learned in the past and how we can apply it. So in 1968, the Vietnam War was scaled infinitely through something called the Tet Offensive in early January. Then we saw the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Then we saw the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy. Then we saw a highly contested political contest highlighted by the bloody and very ugly scene on the streets of Chicago at the Democratic Convention. There were racial tensions all over for people fighting for racial justice and being met with resistance. There were riots, there was violence at a very contested presidential election. Of course, we have this year, which certainly feels different. But every time we get a crisis, we always seem to be able to come back. I think we've all lived through blackouts, especially in this city and this section of the country. We lived through 9/11. We lived through superstorms and hurricanes, you know, to the point where we very often have lost our technology. And we had to go back to real basics in terms of how we support people with special needs. You know, we had to learn early on that you need strong emergency and disaster plans. You need staff in our provider facilities that are well-trained and know how to think on their feet, because sometimes it's not always a person that's going to oversee and provide the direction. You need to have a sense of understanding of what needs to be done. Now we are fortunate, technology connections are very rich. And we have, you know, we certainly have emails and phones and social media to be able to communicate with that help us through these crises. For those of you who don't know, you know, many of our provider organizations in other states are going through even additional trials. There was Anchor, who is the American Network of Community Options and Resources, which is a national trade association made up of providers around the whole country supporting people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, just put out a call for funding because many of the DSPs lost their homes and possessions due to the fires, and they're raising funds for them. Can you imagine being a DSP and losing everything? And so we have to remember to be ready for these kinds of things and learn to live past them. I think there are some lessons again that we relearned. I think that we know that we need to be ready. I just want to go over a couple of some statistics for you all and kind of tie that into what our mission is and how we have to advocate. Right now, and James, you're still on the phone, so you correct me if I'm wrong, but New York State is responsible for the provision of service, you know, OPWDD, for 130,000 New Yorkers with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Services provided by OPD, through 90% of them are through a network, or close to 90% of about 700 not-for-profit provider agencies. In New York State, it is only not-for-profit provider agencies that provide these kinds of service in addition to the state-operated system. Most of those our funding and services include Medicaid-funded long-term care services, as well as habilitation services and clinical services. Probably 60% of the OPWD funding is spent on certified residential congregate care services. Almost 20% on congregate day services, and 22% of the funding goes to the community-based services. All in, when you consider long-term services that we have, and as well as the health portion, healthcare spend for people with intellectual development disabilities, it is over $10.5 billion. $10.5 billion. New York State continues to lead the nation in per-person costs for people with intellectual developmental disabilities, far above any other state, more than twice the national average. So clearly, there has continually been an investment, and we have been working with our state partners as well as our federal partners to continue to ensure that there's sufficient resources. Because we've been hearing that, A, people still are on the waiting list. There is no waiting list, we know, but still are waiting for services one way or another. There is a certified residential opportunity list, of course. But clearly, there continues to be growth in the system, somewhere between 3 and 5% a year. And at a certain point in time, that pie just cannot continue to grow forever. So that's why we're feeling the strain right now that many of us are feeling in terms of the cuts that have been coming down. But even with all of that, again, COVID has been particularly trying situation for us all. Last data we have is from October 7th. We didn't get the most recent data. We know, unfortunately, that 471 individuals with intellectual developmental disabilities passed away as a result of a positive COVID diagnosis. There was over 3,600 confirmed positive cases of COVID in the state since the pandemic began. And a total of over 4,400 staff also tested positive for COVID. Staff. And that really brings me to my next remarks, and that really is that while government provides the resources, certainly they did what they can when they could, but in the initial days of the crisis back in March, it was our DSPs who stood their ground. It was the DSPs, like any good first responder, that when they saw the crisis, they ran towards it. They didn't run away from it. So when I hear great things about first responders, they deserve every bit of it, but so do our DSPs, because they were there and put their lives on the line, along with many of the individuals who succumbed to the coronavirus, so did many of our staff. So they are our everyday heroes, and they deserve to be honored and thanked for it every day. One of the things that the providers had to live through, in addition to trying to find PPEs, trying to access staffing to be able to help support and sustain people's lives within the community. We had many folks that are, many of the staff have had to deal with their own families. We've had cases where individuals basically stayed at a residence and didn't even go home because of fear of bringing the virus home, and the fact that nobody else, because of individual or positive diagnosis, they stayed within the residence to support them. And throughout all of it, one of the key takeaways is the level of communication that's necessary. I mentioned before we need to be able to learn the old lessons, and the old lessons are always been communication. That's with individuals with disabilities and families. With our state partners at OPWD, the communication has been strong, pretty strong mostly throughout everything. New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, after the first month, actually came through helping support the distribution of PPEs throughout New York City's congregate care residential services. As provider associations, we made sure that we were on the same page. We wanted to find out what was going on in Albany as opposed to what's going on downstate. So is that kind of 360 degree communication that is a key takeaway from us, that we continue to have to remember that we are linked together as a community, that we must fight together as a community, advocate together as a community. So what have we been doing in terms of advocacy? It has been, obviously it has been a trying year. What we had tried to do as IAC, in working with our other provider association partners about a year ago, we formed something called New York Disability Advocates. And that's seven provider associations, around the whole state, from Buffalo to Montauk, from Plattsburgh to Staten Island. We continue to have communication and linked. When we first began this year, our first charge was to try and get sustainable resources for the whole community. We had a campaign called 3 for 5. We went to the legislature and informed them that we're not going to be sustainable. I think Lisa mentioned in her opening remarks, we were in financial dire straits before the pandemic. And we knew we had to go to government and tell them that if you truly believe in the mission of supporting people with disabilities, if you truly believe in where we began in 1968 and eventually in 72 with Geraldo Rivera's report on Willowbrook, and in 1975 with the consent decree and the closure of Willowbrook in 1987, where are we here? What are we investing in, what we need to invest in? Willowbrook happened when there was budget cuts. And we were made very clear that we cannot sustain any more cuts and lack of investment on the part of New York State for our provider community, individuals, and families. So certainly we fought hard and we came together as New York Disability Advocates for those purposes. And then COVID hit. That certainly took us to fight for the resources we needed. They were slow in coming in some in many circumstances, but we have kind of gone through the early stages of it as well as we can. We've also linked up, as I mentioned, with Anchor, our nationwide system, and we were able to discuss what waiver flexibilities there were to provide program flexibilities for people in terms of going to their day services as well as other employment services. We organized, car rallies. What we recognized when we had our when we came together as provider associations to form NIDA, we recognized that we needed to work within Albany to be able to get to build a relationship so that we can advocate more effectively. We needed to advocate with our legislature, both the Assembly and the Senate, as well as advocate with the governor. And as you know, the governor has stood strong throughout this pandemic, and yet we still have a lot of areas where we feel the IDD community needs to be taken into consideration at a much, much more higher level. So we have had, some events over this past summer. One of NIDA's desires is to make sure that individuals and families are connected. While individuals and families certainly want to advocate, it is not up to a provider community to tell a parent or to tell a self-advocate or individual what the message has to be. We can provide support and we can provide information as we go along, but certainly each of us separately as well as together as a community need to send the message. I think a great example was the recent parade organized by New York City Fair and the Long Island Advocacy Network for the Developmentally Disabled, LIAND as they call it. I think the families together wanted to make sure that they were going to identify September 17th, I believe it was, I'm blanking on the date, so I apologize. The anniversary of the closure of Willowbrook. So they wanted to organize a car parade. One of the things we did at NIDA was not only to come together, we hired a lobbyist who works with us, who helps develop relationships inside the halls of Albany, but also we hired a public relations firm to help carry the message so that the message gets out about the need for better resources and services for people with intellectual developmental disabilities. So we provided some connections to earned media, newspapers, and some of the local TV stations that picked up the rally, the car rally that was celebrated in Staten Island with a rally on the grounds of Willowbrook from the Staten Island Council, as well as through the car parade, through the boroughs, up across the Mario Cuomo Bridge with a message to the governor. We're going to be doing more of these rallies and more of these events. As you can imagine, the presidential election is pretty much taking all the attention nowadays. So we're going to, we have a ways to go before we get to be able to react and continue to advocate for our community. But we will be there as NIDA, we will be there as IAC, because not only are we advocating for OPWDD services, we're also advocating for education services. I know that Chris is going to be here on Friday, I believe, that he's going to be doing advocacy at an IEP meeting. And I know Winnie will be here talking about reimagining adult day services. So our message continues to be remind government of its responsibilities. And just a couple of final thoughts before I go. I started with remembering lessons of the past and informing your future and informing your current set of circumstances. And I think we've tried to use this experience to think innovatively to solve complex problems. And I think that's one of the things we've been doing. So there's a number of things that we are talking with OPWD. IAC put together guidance considerations and recommendations for the safe return of day services. We issued a white paper. Winnie got together the providers, families, and self-advocates to hear what is working, what's not. We know that OPWD is doing something very similar. Allison McCarthy was out doing an environmental scan to hear what is working for people now. What is not working? Is remote services appropriate for you? Utilizing telehealth. Is that workable for some folks? For some folks, it's been great, and for others, it's not. I've heard from individuals, and I've heard from families who say going to program or going to school means you get on a bus and you go somewhere, or somebody takes you. That the remote option does not work at home. So for some people, you know, things work; some do not. And that really comes back to the real basics, which is ultimately this is a person by person world. We need to live in. This has to be a person-centered approach to what we do. And it continually reminds us that, you know, that we have to determine what each individual person needs and wants and desires before you make any blanket decisions. So we will continue to push there. And finally, I think on, you know, it's difficult when you look at the concerns recently with the cuts that came October 1st to our occupancy, therapeutic leave days, and retainer days. For those of you who know, certainly the provider's reimbursement will be cut. We are trying to make the case with the governor's office and many that this is coming down unfairly, that it's pitting families and providers in a discussion that is very uncomfortable and hard to take when you're looking at the financial health of an organization and the desire for an individual to be at home and not the provider then not being able to bill for those services. So that is a difficult, certainly, challenge for us. Then certainly the resurgence of COVID, the recent hotspots in Brooklyn, Queens, and some of the other counties a little bit upstate. I think right now there's issuance over this past weekend. I think James alluded to it, that OPW is looking to have good communication with providers for those facilities that located in those orange and red and yellow zones, that there were certain restrictions that are needed to be placed on visitation as well as on community outings. It's a tough road, as many of you are seeing in the paper. Europe has just blown up recently. You know, they seem to have it under control, and then look what happens. You relax, and then boom, the virus strikes back again. And we certainly recognize that for those statistics of those who passed away due to COVID, you know, 90% of them had other comorbid conditions. They were health compromised to begin with. So we need to obviously, you know, take these precautions very seriously. And finally, I'll go back to, you know, our ability to be resilient, to live through some tough times, to learn the lessons we need to learn, but also have hope. We made it through 1968. We made it through 9/11 and Sandy, and we made it through some very, very difficult times, and we will get through this. It's going to take a while. And the days will have to grind out one by one. But that does not mean that we will not survive and we will not endure. New York State made this commitment a long time ago. This community, these parents, families, and agencies, we've made a commitment to each other to continue to do this kind of work. So we believe in it. We continue to have hope in it. And ultimately, we'll be the better for it. And there you have it.
Thanks so much, Tom. Thank you. Thanks for sharing everything that's going on and giving us a comprehensive update and for your optimism and reminding us, you know, what we've endured in the past and how we will get through this in time. So I appreciate you being here. Thank you so much. I just want to add one piece since James is still on the call and maybe he can bring it back to the powers that be. The 20% cuts to non-Medicaid services, you know, many families really benefit from like family support contract you know, services provided under the FSS contracts. So that's just one example of the non-Medicaid services that are being cut. And, you know, it was the direction OPW wanted to go in terms of supporting people at home. But I think providers, if this withhold ends up being a full-fledged cut, some providers may give up their family support contracts, and that could impact really, and I'm sure you know this already, James. But if, you know, just sharing that and helping the broader community understand what's going on right now. And we know it's a withhold, and hopefully that's all it will be. But it could be pretty detrimental if it's a, if it becomes a full cut. So, and I just, I want to, since we have a little bit of time, I do want to just go through some names and thank some other folks on the council, like I had mentioned earlier. And because I know you're on the call, and some, we have colleagues and families, and I'm just going to do a quick shout out to our secretary, Marietta Austin, our treasurer, Marissa Fojas, from Adult Services, Josie Davidi and Wendy Schoenfeld, and Sheila Mastrangelo. Our care management chair, Dorothy Wall. From our children's committee, we have Dana Decolator and Rachel Platzkis. From the Family and Community Supports Committee, we have Carlene Henry, Pat Liu, and Melissa Levin-Tormos. From Public Information and Legislative Committee, again, Jim Karp, who's also our parent chair, chairs that committee. We have Eric Fenton, Pat Barrientos again, and Mr. Sinha. From Residential Services, we have Brian Cummings and Joanne Bucciolato. By the way, we are looking for another provider co-chairperson for the Residential Committee. So if anyone's interested, feel free to email me. And then from our Conference Planning and Event Planning Committee, we have Jay Kleinman and Tony Martinez. So really, you know, I'm the voice most of the time, but I couldn't do it without the entire team. So I thank you all. So just a couple of reminders, get the word out for this week. This is a full week event. So take those flyers, pass it on to other families and your colleagues. Visit our website. I'm trying to get folks to use the website more. We keep it updated on a regular basis rather than inundating everyone with emails that sometimes get lost in all of the emails that are out there. So there'll be more information posted. So for today, I'll just go through a quick review of what workshops we have coming up. So today at 12:30, we have Station MD, who'll discuss the benefits of telemedicine. As Tom mentioned, telehealth, it works for many. It's been very helpful during this time. We know it doesn't work for all of our individuals, but I think you'll find it to be a really informative workshop at 12:30 today. Tomorrow, we have folks from Prudential at 10 a.m. Talking about special needs trusts. And then on Wednesday, we have two workshops. We have 10 o'clock in the morning, Reimagining Adult Day Services, and that's Winnie Schiff from IAC, along with Josie Davidi and Wendy Schoenfeld from our Day Services and Transition Committee. And then we have on Wednesday at 12:30, Special Education 101 during COVID-19. And that's from Liliana Diaz-Pedrosa from Advocates for Children. This was a WebEx that Advocates had been doing, and they were kind enough to offer it at our event. So don't miss that on Wednesday at 12:30. Then on Thursday at both 10 a.m. and 6 p.m., our Rachel Platzkis, also is Director of Patient Relations from AmeriKids, will be giving the same presentation twice, in the morning and in the evening. And AmeriKids provides access to home care, occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy services to help families at home. So that is very helpful workshop. Make sure you could get to one of those. And then on Friday, because we know your own personal care is so important, time to unwind and de-stress, we have Laugh Yoga by Loki and Harsh, 10 a.m. Our own Kirbana will introduce them, and it's a presentation they've done for other providers, including parent to parent. So you might not want to miss that, just some me time. And then we have Chris Treber from IAC ending our week with 12:30 with special education advocacy, advocating at IEP meetings and other things that you should know when advocating for your educational needs of your child. So I want to again thank all of our presenters, thank the committee, everyone on today's call, James and Tom, we appreciate you being here. One last item for the council is that, you know, the one positive thing about anything, if we can find positive during these times, that it's pushed us to be more innovative, especially with technology. So if you have ideas and presentations and things that you want to hear, the council can make that happen. And we can schedule Zoom workshops at all different times now. It doesn't have to be restricted to council meetings. So if there are certain topics that you want to hear about, we'll make an effort to get presenters who will do that via Zoom. We can record them so that we can post them on our website and people can see them in the future. So share your thoughts and ideas. So again, thank you all. We wish you an informative week, and please spread the word. Thank you again. Stay well, stay safe, and vote. Thank you.